This week on Making Contact,
I had enough faith to ask questions. Faith doesn't need to be threatened by questions. Dogma, on the other hand, does.
I wanted to see if there was anything I could do so that no other mother would have to sit and watch her child suffer.
Women are gaining influence as leaders throughout the world, fighting for peace, justice, the environment, and civil society. In this program, we profile three courageous women on the forefront of religious debate. Ilana Rosenman is an Orthodox Israeli Jew and a co-director of the Women's Interfaith Encounter in the Middle East. Irshad Manji is a Canadian Muslim and a lesbian feminist on the front lines of Islamic reform. And Catholic Regina O'Callaghan chairs the Northern Ireland Interfaith Forum to support religious diversity in her country. I'm Sandina Robbins, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. This program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising Radio Project. Israeli peace builder Ilana Rosenman is an Orthodox Jew. She became an activist for interfaith understanding through a trial of fire when her son was severely injured in a suicide bombing in Jerusalem.
It was in the beginning of September, and one beautiful afternoon, I dropped my son off in the middle of the city to meet friends in the center of town where all the cafes are. And an hour later, there were three suicide bombers that blew themselves up along the main covered street there. And my son Noam, who was 16 at the time, was in between two bombers. So he was essentially really in two bombings, 30 seconds apart. He was very fortunate in that a young girl a few feet away from him received one piece of shrapnel that went right into her heart, and she died instantly. He had 100 pieces of shrapnel that tore his body and lived through it. The shrapnel broke bones. His leg was set with a steel plate because his leg was shattered and large chunks of his body were torn off. His eardrums were perforated. The 40% burns on his body required 6 weeks in the burn unit with daily burn treatment, which is really like a torture. So that's what happened to Noam. And I ended up sleeping on a mattress next to his bed in the hospital for 2 months while he was going through burn treatment. And I had a lot of time to think. And it became somehow clear to me in all of that, that first of all, I wanted to see if there was anything I could do so that no other mother would have to sit and watch her child suffer the way I was doing. And I also saw that there was a tremendous camaraderie among all the women, the mothers in the burn unit who were sitting with their children. And I just felt that women are suffering so enormously in what's going on. And in our part of the world, in the Middle East, the women's voice is seldomly heard. There are very few women involved in Israel politically, and in other countries, none. Religiously, there are no women, no female clergy. It's priests and rabbis and sheikhs and imams. So there, you just don't hear women much, except when they're at the graveside screaming and mourning for their husbands or their children. And I thought a lot about all of that. And it gave me insight, and I mustered the energy to seek other women who wanted to find a way to have normal human relationships together as a way to just build human understanding and sisterhood and love, and to see how to live in peace together on an immediate personal level, not worrying about what the politicians are doing or going to do or the generals or anyone else, but just for women to get together and be women together and transcend the hatred and the stereotypes and all the other stuff.
Ilana sought out Yehuda Stoloff, head of the Interfaith Encounter Association in Israel, who encouraged her to start the Women's Interfaith Encounter. Ilana has been working for 6 years, co-directing the organization with her Christian and Muslim partners. Together, they have gathered hundreds of women in a network that spans all of Israel, East Jerusalem, and the occupied territories. In the coming year, they hope to convene a conference in Jordan, bringing together women from all over the Middle East and throughout the world.
I went to an interfaith conference in Berlin. And there I found myself with a woman named Ibtisam Mahmid, who was from Furadis, a town in Israel. And we were put together in the same room. And shortly after we got there, it was nighttime. And so it was time to go to bed. And there were two beds next to each other. The next day, we found out that everyone else, of course, pushed their beds to separate sides of the room because no one knew each other. And, you know, it wasn't couples or anything. But Ibtisam and I were going to sleep nose to nose and talking about our families and our children and everything else. And finally, we were getting tired. So Ibtisam said to me, you know, if any of my friends back in Faradis knew that I'm going to sleep with a strange Jewish woman right next to me, they'd say, well, aren't you afraid that she'll wake up during the night and knife you? And I, without thinking, burst out and said, Ibtisam, you Arabs are the ones who knife us. I'm the one who should be afraid. And of course, at that point, we just burst out laughing. And we said, we have to work together. Because we realized within several hours of being together, we'd gotten down to the primal fear that the other one is going to kill me.
Ibtisam Mahmid became the Muslim coordinator for Northern Israel and has worked with Ilana on numerous projects for the Women's Interfaith Encounter.
People say to me all the time, how can you have interfaith dialogue? I mean, you know, you got to be political. It's all political. How can you keep politics out? Isn't it artificial and you're avoiding the big problems and the big issues? But to me, I mean, this is an example. Of course, the politics are always there. But our approach is how do we go to our faith and use our faith to see how to deal with the political issues that are going on and to see how to be strengthened by our religion rather than to go along with the religious distortions which are fueling the conflict and perpetuating it and justifying it. So we have a very tall task that we've taken upon ourselves to really look at and search for the wisdom and truth in our religions and to really find the ways that our religions specifically speak out against violence and to strengthen our own awareness of that, strengthen our co-religionists' awareness of that. So we go about our business and we have our normal lives and we have our meetings in spite of bombings and incursions and assassinations. And we just know we don't need to talk about a peace plan or what peace would be like or how do you create peace. While we're together in our meetings, any meetings, peace exists. We're in peace. And for me, I know it keeps me sane because you cannot live in the madness of violence, in the insanity of vengeance, without something that can keep you sane. And this keeps me sane.
We'll have more about Women Rising in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. This program is a collaboration with the Women Rising Radio Project. If you'd like more information, or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit us on the web at radioproject.org. The Jakarta Post recently hailed Irshad Manji as one of three Muslim women making a difference worldwide. Irshad is a Canadian writer, a lesbian feminist activist, former host of Canada's popular Queer Television, and an outspoken Muslim reformer. Her book, The Trouble with Islam Today, has been translated into several languages and is coming out in Farsi for circulation in Iran. Irshad has been questioning authority, religious and other, since her childhood and facing down intimidation all along.
I remember, for example, one night my father chasing me through the house with a knife in his hand, threatening to cut off my ear. And I flew out of my bedroom window, scrambled up to the rooftop, and stayed the rest of the night on top of the house. My mother was working the graveyard shift at an airline company. She was a cleaning person, so she didn't know what was going on that night. But I do say that even if my mom was home and had tried to bring me down from the roof with assurances of safety, honestly, I don't think that I would have come down that night for this reason. As I surveyed the neighborhood from the very peak of my roof, I saw a world of open-ended possibility, and I made the emotional commitment that I would not be stuck in the kind of situation that forced me to succumb to ultimatums. I remember making that pact with myself that night. And, you know, the kinds of freedoms that I've experienced in my public school, where I could actually debate with my vice principal over issues of religion. He was an evangelical Christian. I was a pretty devout Muslim. The fact that I saw an evangelical Christian willing to engage me rather than shut me down. The fact that I could go to the public library, this was pre-internet days, thank goodness, and read about all kinds of commentaries having to do with Islam. All of these kinds of freedoms made me realize at a very young age how profoundly lucky I am to have wound up in a part of the world where as a Muslim girl, and now as a Muslim woman, I can dream big dreams and tap much if not most of my potential. This is a precious gift. And I made the commitment to myself as a child that I would not turn my back on that gift because so many other Muslims did not and still do not have that gift. My family and I are refugees from Idi Amin's Uganda. We settled just outside of Vancouver in 1972, and I grew up attending two types of schools, the public, secular, regular school of most North American children, and then on top of that, every Saturday, for several hours at a stretch, the Islamic religious school, the madrasa. And that's where I regularly imbibed two major messages, that women are inferior and that the Jews are treacherous, not to be trusted. Now, please understand, I have never said, nor would I ever say, that every madrasa teaches these things. How the hell would I know what every madrasa teaches? I haven't entered every one of them, thank goodness for them, and not just for me. But, you know, since I'm conveying where my passion for these issues comes from, I think it's vital that I share my lived experiences. And those lived experiences include the fact that even back then, at the age of 8, 9, 10, I had enough faith to ask questions like, why can't girls lead prayer? A question I know many Jewish and Christian women have wanted to ask of their own ayatollahs, and many have. I graduated, entirely metaphorically, I assure you, to asking more sophisticated questions like, if the Quran came to Prophet Muhammad as a message of peace, then why, even after receiving that message, did he command his army to slay an entire Jewish tribe? Well, you can appreciate that such questions irritated the hell out of my madrasa teacher, who, at least in his case, felt quite entitled, thank you, to put down women and trash the Jews. And so it's not surprising that he and I reached our ultimate impasse over yet another one of my ignorant, annoying questions. Namely, where is the evidence for the so-called Jewish conspiracy against the faith of Islam? You love to talk about it, sir. Tell me, where is the proof? Well, that question, asked at the age of 14, finally got me booted out of the madrasa. Out of fairness, I took time over the next 20 years to study Islam on my own. And I'm glad I did, because that's when I learned what is worth salvaging about Islam. I learned about an amazing concept in Islam called ijtihad. Ijtihad. Now, I realize that this word sounds frighteningly like jihad to many non-Arab ears. And in fact, it comes from the same root as jihad, to struggle. But unlike any notion of violent struggle, ijtihad is all about independent thinking and independent reasoning. During my self-study, I learned that in the early decades of Islam, thanks to the spirit of ijtihad, scholars would teach their students to abandon, quote, expert opinion about the Quran if their own conversations with the ambiguous Quran came up with better evidence for their peaceful ideas. Now, as a feminist, let me tell you what else leapt out at me as I did my self-study. I learned about Khadija, the Prophet Muhammad's beloved first wife, who was 15 years older than he and who proposed marriage to him. I learned about Aisha, the Prophet's beloved last wife, whom he married after Khadija died. Aisha is quietly regarded by many Muslims as the real successor to the Prophet Muhammad because she made so many important decisions, both on the battlefield and behind the scenes. I learned about Rabia, a Sufi Muslim, and Sufis are the mystics of Islam. According to Islamic legend, Rabia was given her choice of suitors, and after she interviewed the most smart, the most clever of those suitors, she realized that she in fact did not need a husband in order to be whole and fulfilled, and so she remained single. This is according to Islamic tradition itself. And to give Muslim men where credit is due, I learned that in his farewell sermon to Muslims, the Prophet Muhammad declared women to be the partners, not the commodities of men.
Irshad, a devout Muslim, is troubled by how Islam is practiced today and the influence of Arabic culture on Muslims worldwide.
In Arab culture, honor refers to that tradition which requires women to give up their individuality in order to maintain the reputation of the men in their lives. This, in effect, turns Arab women into communal property, property of the community, so that their lives don't actually belong to them. Their lives belong to a wider group of people, their families, their tribes, often even their nations. Which means that when a Muslim woman to whom honor is applied is accused of dishonoring, of shaming, of breaking moral codes, the punishment against her can be so much bigger than even the supposed crime that she has been charged with merits. And the most tragic part of all of this, in my view, is that even though Arabs represent only 20% of Muslims worldwide, more than 80% of Muslims are non-Arabs, nonetheless, this concept of honor has been grafted onto non-Arab cultures in the Muslim world, so that women in Malaysia, in Indonesia, in India, in Afghanistan, in Iran, and I can also tell you in parts of Canada, where I come from, suffer from this very much. So much so that there is a story breaking in Canada, and will go on for a while, about the proposal to introduce Sharia courts. Sharia refers to Islamic law. Well, guess what? The number one source of resistance to that notion comes from Muslim women themselves. Some who wear hijab, the headscarf, some who don't, some whom consider themselves very religious, others who consider themselves secular. But what are they protesting when they oppose the introduction of Sharia courts? They're not protesting Islam. They're not even protesting the Quran. They're protesting the common sense filter of honor through which the Quran will be interpreted. And what they fear, very justifiably, is that their rights, which are given to them in the Quran and which are given to them under Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms, will be taken away because of the application of honor.
Irshad Manji has faced public wrath often during the years of her career, particularly as host of Canada's controversial Queer Television. She says the hostility made her stronger.
Now, you would never think, right, logically, that being an on-camera lesbian would somehow prepare you for also being a Muslim reformer. But it prepared me in at least two ways. One is that I received no shortage of death threats while I was hosting Queer Television. And as a result, this steeled my spine for what was to come when I finished writing The Trouble with Islam Today. Only this morning, as I checked my emails, which I do every morning for security reasons, I received yet another threat that says, Irshad, the brothers are out to get you and they are planning on your demise very, very soon. And the person who wrote this email said that just what Theo van Gogh in the Netherlands experienced, and just what a Christian Assyrian family here in the United States, in New Jersey in particular, recently experienced, namely mass slaughter at the hands of what are thought to be radical Islamists. So you will soon be experiencing the same. Please take this as your final warning and repent. So ultimately, simply being a free thinker and having been born a woman puts me on the front lines of the firing squad. I realize that. And yet that's the risk that you have to take at this early stage in the liberal reformation of Islam if anything is going to change.
Regina O'Callaghan is a founder and leader of the Northern Ireland Interfaith Forum, whose purpose is to educate for multicultural diversity in a country defined by its historical conflict between Catholics and Protestants, nationalists and unionists. Regina was born and raised a Catholic, but she's made life choices which transcend her sectarian upbringing.
I didn't marry, not through any conviction, but because the right person didn't turn up until I was 48. And then my husband turned up in the shape of a Hindu from India, and which was quite a shock to the system. We got married then 2 years later when I was 50, and that and the formation of the Interfaith Forum all happened around about the same time. So, as I say, things happen in your life which kind of pushes you in another direction. So that was a dual happening that kind of pushed me towards interfaith, I think. When I met my husband first, and we talked about getting married, my mother, who was a very staunch Catholic all her life, said to me, "Well, of course he'll be getting baptized before you get married." And I said, "No, Mother, I don't think so. There was no immediate plans for that." And she said, "Why not? He's an intelligent man. Can't he see that we're right?" So I think that kind of expresses a mindset of where I came from, but hopefully I have moved on from there. To know people, first of all, from different faith traditions, and to marry somebody from a different faith tradition, because having married, I have lots of relations now in the States and in India, and I've got to know a lot about the Hindu traditions through them, and I think I have grown as a person by knowing somebody from a different faith tradition. It's been a wonderful blessing in my life. As a group, over the years, for about the last 5 years, we have had some funding from government, from the Northern Ireland government, under Community Relations Fund. And with that, we've been able to be involved in various projects, most of them to do with education. But one of the first projects we had was we set up a prayer room at the International Airport, which has... It has artifacts and books and readings from all the major faith traditions, and it's a place where people can go. We had a major exhibition of all the faiths in Northern Ireland, which went around the province to libraries and so on. We have lobbied the Department of Education quite extensively for a more inclusive religious education syllabus in schools. And we have done a lot of training of public and private sector bodies, again with the help of money from Community Relations Department. We would regard our our main work as educating basically out of ignorance, because an awful lot of prejudice and wrong information comes out of people's ignorance. And a kind of a, there is here in Northern Ireland a very narrow, among some people, a very narrow view of what the world is about and what is right. And there are people who will not listen to any other point of view or won't even recognize that anybody else's point of view is authentic. And I think that would be what we would hope to do. We would hope to make people aware that knowing about other people and understanding other people's views, their views about religion or their views about politics, will not harm you in any way. Sort of knowledge can never harm. Knowledge can only expand your mind, and finding out about someone else's faith won't cause you to lose your own faith. It, in fact, the opposite happens.
In recent decades, the Irish have turned away from the Catholic Church in large numbers. Regina O'Callaghan sees in this trend a newfound independence in Irish religious thought.
I think now this is a much more secular society, and I think the power of religion now, it's a holier power. People who are interested in religion now are not interested out of fear. They're no longer motivated by fear or by authority. People who are interested in religion nowadays are interested because they realise that as human beings we do have a spiritual dimension. We're body, mind and spirit, and that all three of these dimensions must be in unity with one another. If you neglect one of these, you're neglecting part of yourself and part of your development. And I think people are coming to realise that now, that religion is a force, or has the potential to be a force for great good. I think we're coming to a time when people no longer obey through fear. People are religious through love.
That's it for this Women's Desk edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. Special thanks this week to associate producer Pauline Bartolone. These profiles of international changemakers were co-produced with Lynn Feinerman's Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. You can learn more about the work of these courageous women at radioproject.org. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Additional music by Khaled Dubran, Alan Stivell, and Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. If you'd like to support our work, or if you have ideas for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. For a cassette or CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Justin Beck, associate producer, Dorian Taylor, communications manager, Esther Mania, office manager, Tom Evans, development associate, Peggy Law, founding director, Norman Solomon, senior advisor, David Barsamian, national advisor, and I'm your host this week, Sandina Robbins.